privilege to introduce Dr. Hans Flicks to you. You have his CV, a rather modest one given his attainments, but I won't add to that except to add one thing. I think of all the speakers in this program, I'm sure he's the one I've known longest. Nearly 40 years ago, as a very junior legal officer in the United Nations Secretariat, this very eminent Swedish foreign ministry official was very kind to me, and there's been a great bondship ever since. Partly built in the mid-70s when the diplomatic conference was meeting to prepare what became the 1977 protocols, and occasionally since then we catch up. So it's great, Hans, to have you here and to hear about the important work that you've been doing on reducing the role and effect of weapons. Would you please welcome Dr. Hans Flicks?
Great pleasure to be back in New Zealand. I was here in 1999, invited by Cathy and Jocelyn, and addressing more general questions of law and international affairs. And I'm very glad to be here to the Red Cross Conference. A principal and time-honored task for the Red Cross and the Red Crescent is to seek to reduce the suffering and injuries inflicted by armed conflict. And we have come a long way in the 1.5 century since the Battle of Solferino and the start of Henri Dunant's quest to ameliorate the consequences of war and other disasters. However, we don't need to look very far to see that this task remains a very large one. The news flood with information about the taking and killing of hostages, the use of civilians as a shield against attack, the use of children as soldiers, the use of torture, the use of cluster bombs and incendiary bombs. Can we reduce the horrors of which we see so many examples, and how shall we go about it? When you strive to outlaw specific arms or methods of warfare, you sometimes meet the comment, as I've often met the comment, that this is a band-aid approach, half-hearted, like reducing a tumor rather than removing it. And the results you may attain will be marginal, you may be told. One answer to this skeptical attitude is that for those who benefit from the marginal reduction of cruelty and suffering, the efforts are certainly meaningful. Another is that the efforts to reduce the suffering and injuries brought by the use of arms in no way signals that you accept or acquiesce in the use of armed force, only that you acknowledge the fact that such use is taking place and that the consequences must be mitigated if you can. There is a certain compartmentalization of our efforts to eliminate or at least to mitigate the suffering resulting from the use of arms. First, we may seek to prevent or curtail the use of armed force between or within states to abolish war. No use of arms, no injuries. In our national communities, we do not accept the use of armed force, except in limited cases, defined situations of self-defense, and by the police acting under laws. We strive for the same thing in the international sphere. This is the aim of the UN Charter, to do away with the use of force and to have rules and mechanisms for the peaceful settlement of disputes. Secondly, we may seek to reduce or eliminate the availability of weapons. At the national level, we have, in most countries, disarmed ourselves as a citizenry and reduce the use of violence. If you don't have any arms in your revolver, in your drawer, well, the temptation is not there. So doing away with the weapons themselves, the availability of the weapons. Police and national armed forces have the monopoly on the possession and the use of the arms. It was not always that way. You look back at the Middle Ages and men would wear sables and they would wear arms all the way. Internationally, we seek arms control and disarmament to reduce the risk of weapons use. And the results have disarmament efforts have been somewhat limited. Third, without seeking to stop the production of arms or availability of arms, or to arrange for the dismantlement of weapons, we may seek to exclude or limit or circumscribe the use of particularly cruel weapons or methods of warfare. This is the approach of the international humanitarian law, as we find it in the Hague Conventions and Geneva Conventions, and in the protocols attached to these conventions. We must remember that all these three approaches have the same aim, namely to prevent the suffering and waste that is linked to the use of armed force. And I should like to make some comments on each of them. And I begin with international humanitarian law, the Hague Law, Geneva Law. Together with my good friend, who is now a justice and judge on the international bench of the International Court of Justice, and I'm very happy that there's a New Zealander on the bench of the International Court of Justice at The Hague. It's a tribute to his own erudition and skill and the respect that the world has for him. And also, I would say, we owe a tribute to his wife, Jocelyn, who has been active and remains very active in the International Red Cross. Together with Ken, I took part in the process that started the ICRC conferences in Geneva in the early 1970s on international humanitarian law, and that continued in the state-level conferences called by the Swiss government. This resulted in two additional protocols to the 1949 Geneva Conventions, and later the Convention and Protocols on Particularly Injurious Weapons in 1980, protocols on which I worked particularly hard at the instructions of Alva Myrdal, who was the Minister of Stockholm. The Hague Conventions in 1899 had prohibited the use of poison as a weapon in war, and the Geneva Protocol in 1925 were adopted after the extensive gas warfare in the First World War. They prohibited the use of chemical and bacteriological weapons. You see the evolution from the Hague 1899 gas, and then Geneva 1925 gas, chemical weapons and bacteriological warfare, much broader. The additional protocols of 1977 to the Geneva Convention prohibited in general terms the use of particularly injurious weapons and methods in warfare, causing widespread and long-term and severe damage to the natural environment. Again, the expansion much to the covering also the environment. The regulation of the use of specific types of weapons was not dealt with in depth in the 1977 protocols, but the protocols regulated quite a number of other issues of importance even today: the status of combatants, the protection of civilians, and the definition of legitimate targets, among many other very important controversial issues. The 1980 Convention on the Prohibition and Restrictions on the Use of Certain Conventional Weapons, which may be deemed to be excessively injurious or have indiscriminate effects, and its protocols attached to that convention, went to prohibit the use of weapons that relied on fragments that could not be seen on X-ray. There were such weapons. And they caused the suffering. They couldn't be identified and found in the body of the injured. They also attached a protocol on anti-personnel landmines that would prohibit them if they were not self-destructive. And a protocol prohibited the use of incendiary weapons in urbanized areas. The protocol also required that maps of minefields should be handed over after hostilities. All very practical measures, and we have seen during the Vietnam War a number of examples of the use of mines, anti-personnel mines, that did not self-destruct. And similarly, for the world, large parts of the world have landmines still, which have not been destroyed and which cause hazards in Cambodia and Libyan desert and many other places. Geneva efforts of the 1970s, one might say, were relatively successful lawmaking. Most of the rules were adopted by consensus and may still be seen as standard setting. However, some reservations must be made. For example, important countries such as the United States, Israel, Iran, Pakistan, and others have not had yet to ratify the 1997 additional protocol. And the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons to date has only 102 ratifications. So there is a need for more adherence, and there is, of course, a need for implementation, for respect for the rules that have been adopted. And new armed conflicts raise new challenges, and work has proceeded from where we left off in the 1970s. There have been some successful and some less successful attempts to develop the law, the body of law, restraining the means and methods of warfare. And first, let me some of the progress, mention progress that has been made. In the 1980 Convention on Prohibition, on restriction of use of certain injurious weapons, has been amended by two more protocols since then. One, which deals with laser weapons. And laser, as you realize, can the anti-personnel way can be used with blind people without killing them. Protocol 5, dealing with explosive remnants of war. In addition to those documents, instruments that relate to the 1980 Convention, we have the 1997 Ottawa Convention about the stockpiling, production, and transfer of anti-personnel mines and their destruction. And that is also an important step forward, although it also misses the ratification of a number of important countries. In other areas, there's still very much lawmaking work to do. The small caliber weapons, which will be discussed here later, kill more people than any other type of weapon. And there are some 500 to 600 million small arms currently circulating in the world. And these weapons are rightly called Africa's weapons of mass destruction. In 2001, the General Assembly adopted the UN Protocol against the illicit manufacturing and trafficking in firearms. It entered into force in 2005. However, only 64 states have ratified this protocol. Cluster munitions, cluster bombs, are not yet specifically regulated in any convention, despite the severe damages they have, particularly when they're being used in areas with civilians. And in February this year, the process was initiated by Norway, championed by a group of states, including New Zealand, to ban cluster munitions that cause unacceptable harm to civilians. This is called the Oslo process, and is still ongoing. There have been many developments in the field of humanitarian law in the last century. Important steps have also been taken to deal with the most serious crimes against humanity and to fight the impunity for gross human rights violations. A legacy from the Nuremberg Tribunal has been carried on through the special tribunals which have been established under the UN Security Council mandate, most notably the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, where international criminal procedures are handled. The adoption of the Rome Statute in 1998 and the subsequent establishment of the International Criminal Court is a landmark for efforts to end impunity for international crimes, regardless of the context in which they are perpetrated. A conceptual breakthrough in the protection of the individual rights was the unanimous adoption in the United Nations in 2005 and 2006 of the principle that's called responsibility to protect. And that entails a duty for the international community, including the United Nations, to take action to protect individuals from large-scale violations of basic human rights. It is starting out from the premise that the state, yes, has its rights protected by the UN Charter, they must not be violated, but at the same time the state has a responsibility also to protect its citizens, and if it fails to do so, the international community can come in with a variety of methods and means, milder or stronger. It will probably still take a long time to find the proper tools to transform that historic decision into reality. But the agreement is a conceptual breakthrough and a large step forward. Despite the progress made, there are still important unsettled areas. An example is, of course, the regulation of the combatant status. The question was dealt with constructively in the 1977 protocols. Nevertheless, the status of combatants is often not clear in the contemporary asymmetric conflict. The debate on illegal enemy combatants, unquote, is perhaps the most significant illustration of this problem. These are all challenges for the next generation of international and humanitarian workers, lawyers, and diplomats, and the continued commitment and the role of the Red Cross societies around the world and the ICRC is indispensable. They took the initiative to the conference in 1977, and I think they also remain the principal force for further efforts to reduce the suffering in armed conflicts. Now the second approach I mentioned is disarmament and arms control, to limit the threat of the existing weapons and to seek to do away with the weapons. The Hague Conventions from 1899, as I mentioned, prohibited the use of poison as a weapon in war. The 1925 Protocol proceeded on that and expanded it. And in 1972, a convention was concluded that went further than the Geneva Protocol and prohibited even the production and possession of biological weapons. This was during the Cold War, and the U.S., under the initiative of Nixon actually, to ban the production and use of biological weapons. They did not think at the time that biological weapons had much military significance, and that helped them to agree to ban it altogether. So going beyond the 25 Protocol, which only was directed to use, this convention of 1972 prohibited the production and the possession of the weapon. However, during the Cold War, without any mechanism for verification, which was important, the Soviets, the communists, actually cheated on a large scale with it and built up biological weapons, and so did the Iraqis. In 1993, another convention was adopted in the UN prohibiting the production and possession of chemical weapons. So again, going beyond Geneva, which only prohibited the use of chemical weapons, gas warfare, this convention in 1993 concluded at the end, after the end of the Cold War, they prohibited the production, possession, and use of chemical weapons. And this one is provided both with inspection, the means of verification. So it's probably the most advanced, most modern of the conventions that we have concerning weapons. These conventions are not yet ratified by all, but there's a good hope that they will, and we see, for instance, in Russia and the United States that the big, huge stocks of chemical weapons are gradually being destroyed. They are behind the schedule, but they are being destroyed, so it's great progress that's being made. For nuclear weapons, on the other hand, as I should explain in detail, we have not come this far. Indeed, I might say that we are at an impasse. In 1945, the power of nuclear weapons was demonstrated in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the world saw how hundreds of thousands of civilians could be destroyed in single attacks. The term weapons of mass destruction was coined, and the tragedies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki led to the declaration in the very first United Nations General Assembly resolution. The very first resolution of the General Assembly of the United Nations dealt with nuclear weapons and expressed the determination to physically eliminate atomic weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. There was a sense of urgency in the process, since they felt that it was only a matter of time before more states could acquire the technology and produce their own weapons. Unfortunately, this sense of urgency in 1946 was not really followed up by an urgency of action. Only in 1968, over 20 years, and four new nuclear weapon states later, the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968 was adopted. To establish confidence, one needed to prohibit the very possession of nuclear weapons, just as one had done with biological and chemical weapons, rather than just prohibiting the use of nuclear weapons. Sadly, another reason for the construction of prohibiting the possession of nuclear weapons for non-nuclear weapon states was that the five states that possessed the nuclear weapons were not ready to promise not to use them. Only three states have remained outside the NPT regime, India, Israel, and Pakistan, and all have subsequently developed nuclear weapons. The NPT is based on a double bargain. The non-nuclear weapon states were invited to commit themselves to stay without nuclear weapons, while the five nuclear weapon states were invited to commit themselves to negotiate towards nuclear disarmament. Ironically, these commitments given by the non-nuclear weapon states and the nuclear weapon states was followed by an arms race, reaching a peak of some 55,000 nuclear warheads during the height of the Cold War. And when the Berlin Wall crumbled in 1989, there were some hopes that a revival of disarmament and arms control was ahead. We were expecting the peace dividend, and we were expecting disarmament. And while there has been progress, such as a reduction of the number of nuclear warheads, bringing the number now to present, perhaps something around 27,000 warheads, the indefinite prolongation of the NPT in 1995, the treaty was prolonged for a definite period of time. This was a success, and we had the adoption of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1996. The adoption, I say, of the Test Ban Treaty in 1996, a tea treaty that prohibits any nuclear weapons test in any atmosphere, whether underwater or underground. Nevertheless, the evolution since the end of the Cold War has been disappointing, and I point out already now that the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has not entered into force because it lacks the ratification by quite a number of states that whose ratifications are necessary to bring it into force. The failure of the latest review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty in May 2005 and the inability of the United Nations Summit in September of 2005 to agree to a single line on arms control and disarmament is very worrying. There is a dire need to revive disarmament efforts and wake up from what former Secretary General Kofi Annan has called sleepwalking into new arms races. There have, however, regrettably, been a number of wake-up calls. For instance, the North Koreans' test of a nuclear device, their earlier test of a missile, the modernization and further development of the United States' standard nuclear weapon demanded by the present U.S. administration, the U.K. decision to renew its nuclear Trident program, the Chinese shooting down one of its own satellites in space. These are symptoms of the arms race that's going on. Perhaps one of the least observed and one of the more important is the arms race about space and the risk that conventional weapons will be placed in space. The world is investing billions of dollars in space, and all our mobile phones, communications, GPS and whatnot depend upon it. And you have armies of engineers who are working to improve this for the use of the humanity, but regrettably you have another army of engineers who are working diligently to see how we can shoot the whole thing to pieces and make a sort of junkyard of space. This is not much discussed, and it ought to be discussed by commenting fora of the international community, notably in Geneva. You know that Al Gore has succeeded in coining the phrase an inconvenient truth. Climate change, global warming is one inconvenient truth that people everywhere now has come to realize. But there is a second inconvenient truth, and that is the continued existence and further development of nuclear weapon systems. Are we on the brink of a nuclear disaster? Well, we often hear warnings that the NPT, the treaty, risks collapse. And they point to Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and Libya. The good news is that the world is not replete with would-be violators. The overwhelming commitment to the treaty remains of tremendous value. The five original nuclear weapon states have been joined by four others since 1968. But at the same time, the vast majority of states have given up the nuclear weapons option and joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Libya and Iraq were both found to be in violation of their commitments, but they were brought back to observance. And with regard to North Korea and Iran, the world is actively seeking solutions through negotiations. For the next 5 to 10 years at least, there appear to be no other problematic cases. People simply think that, yes, there are lots of countries around that might go for nuclear weapons. But when you look around, you realize that you need two things. You need a certain technical ability and resources to make use of them, and you need the willpower to use it too. And in many, many cases, talk about the Gulf states or Jordan or Egypt, or these states, they do not have the technical ability. I don't think they really have the willpower either today. But countries like Japan, Algeria, who are more technically advanced, we are convinced, lack the willpower at the current time to do so. Still, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is under strain. There is a frustration that the nuclear weapon states, having had almost 40 years to negotiate towards nuclear disarmament, are not living up to their end of the bargain. No doubt the prevention of further proliferation spread to other states, or nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorist acquisition is vital. The work against that is vital. However, it is hardly a recipe for success to preach to the rest of the world that they must stay away from the very weapons that nuclear weapon states claim are indispensable to their own country. It's sort of like sitting and smoking a big cigar and telling your children, stay away from all smoking. It's not the best approach. Disarmament and non-proliferation, then, are two sides of the same coin. In June 2006, I presented a report of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, the WMDC, which it's been my privilege to chair since the beginning of 2004. It was initiated by the former Swedish Foreign Minister, Anna Lindh, who was tragically murdered in 2003. The commission consisted of 14 experts on arms control and disarmament and non-proliferation from all parts of the world. We aimed at providing an overview, a roadmap, for moving forward towards the elimination of reduction dangers from weapons of mass destruction. We concluded that while such weapons might be particularly dangerous in some hands, they are a risk to the world in whosoever hands, whether big powers or small powers. We presented some 60 recommendations, half of which deal with nuclear weapons. And one of the key recommendations dealt with the entry into force of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which I mentioned a moment ago. This, in my view, is the single most important issue on the nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation agenda today. If the United States Senate that rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty once, partly out of spite against Mr. Clinton, partly for other reasons, if they were to review the treaty and reconsider it and adopt it, and the U.S. were to become a party to the treaty, then I think it's highly likely that China would also move in the same direction. If China does so, then India will. If India does, very likely Pakistan will, and so forth. You will have not a vicious circle, but you will have a virtuous circle. So this is on the top of the agenda. Another important issue is the negotiation of an internationally verifiable treaty that cuts off the production of material that are used in nuclear weapons. Let's say either enriched uranium, enrichment up to 90%, and plutonium, to cut off the further production of these materials for weapons purposes and do it in a way that is verifiable. Our commission also made recommendations of further reductions in strategic nuclear arsenals in the US and Russia, and the withdrawal of all nuclear weapons from forward deployment in Europe. Nothing particular at the present time, but there's tension between Russia and the US and Europe about the placing of parts of the U.S. missile shield in Poland and the Czech Republic, an agreement to withdraw the nuclear weapons from forward position in Europe would be useful. American NATO bombs to go to the U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons to go further into central storages deeper into the Soviet Union. Our commission also urged regional approaches in sensitive areas such as the Korean Peninsula and in the Middle East. The Korean Peninsula, any agreement will contain a clause that will prohibit both the Korean states from having enrichment installations and reprocessing installations. And the same might well be an idea for the Middle East, not just asking Iran to stay away from enrichment, but to ask also the other countries of the Middle East to stay away from it, and to ask Israel to stay away from any further reprocessing. So the regional approach is a valid and important one. Our commission also made some, what you might call, procedural suggestions. For example, introducing a two-thirds majority rule for the adoption of the agenda at the Conference of Disarmament in Geneva. That conference, which I joined as a young legal assistant in 1963, I think it was, they had, as a result of the Cold War, they had always operated by consensus. But the reality is that today the General Assembly can, by decision of simple majority, take up any disarmament issue. But in Geneva, if you want to discuss it at the conference that is specifically for disarmament, then you need to have unanimity. So you can discuss things in New York, but not in Geneva. And we suggest that at least by two-thirds majority, you should be able to take up an item. Conference has not been able to adopt the work program for over 10 years now. And this is the world's central organ for discussing disarmament. We are also suggesting convening after thorough preparation of a UN World Summit dealing exclusively with disarmament, non-proliferation, and terrorist use of weapons of mass destruction. And this partly to compensate for the debacle that we had in 2005 when there was the UN World Summit and they were not able to adopt a single line on arms control on disarmament. The full text of our report can be found on the Commission website, www.wmdcommission.org, and I think that copies of the report might be available here in Wellington as well. The report was presented at a time when confidence in multilateral disarmament negotiations was at the bottom. Since then, there have been some little movement in a more constructive direction. In January of this year, the former U.S. Secretaries of State, Kissinger and Schultz, together with former Secretary of State Bill Perry, who was also a member of my commission, and former Senator Sam Nunn, published an article in the Wall Street Journal entitled Nuclear Madness. They proposed a number of concrete steps to be taken to reduce the dangers of nuclear weapons and eventually to reach the elimination of nuclear weapons in the same manner as Gorbachev and the American president had agreed on in, or nearly agreed upon in Reykjavik at their meeting. And they suggest in particular that the United States should take an initiative to, vis-a-vis the other nuclear weapon states, to begin between themselves to move towards nuclear disarmament. This is the central part of the article. This article and the discussion that it has provoked, I think, and I hope, and I trust, is indicative of a movement within the United States and of a momentum for international arms control and disarmament efforts. It shows that despite the rather pugnacious profile that we have seen of the Bush administration, there is also a strong current, including Republicans. Recently, Senator Hagel, a Republican prominent member of the External Foreign Relations Committee, together with the presidential candidate Obama, a Democrat, went to the Senate with a proposal for legislation with a number of important disarmament issues. So there is a current that goes against the current one, and the current that has, after Iraq and Lebanon, I think, come to the conclusion that there are severe limits as to what you can do by way of military techniques to abolish weapons of mass destruction or to settle diplomatic disputes. So the question is, I think for the moment, is the United States ready to reoccupy the driver's seat in the international efforts for arms control and disarmament? We were used, those who have been around for a long time, we were used to see the United States as the lead wolf in the field, and now for some time we have seen them as the lone wolf, and I think we would like to see them back in the role as the lead wolf. Now turning to the non-use of force, last bit. We feel frustration that the world is not weaned off violence, armed violence. But when we feel that frustration, I think we might take some consolation in a longer-term perspective, looking backward somewhat. And I find in my studies that Machiavelli, who is known to all of us who lived in there, from 1492 to 1550, he wrote at that time, and I quote, that war is just, which is necessary. And every sovereign entity may decide on the occasion for war. It was as simple as that. Even in the 19th century, the right of states to go to war was not challenged. However, views were beginning to change with Henri Dunant and with the Red Cross and the Hague conferences. And it was commonly stressed that war should be a means of last resort, and rules began to be adopted against the particularly cruel weapons, like the dumb bullet. So that was the beginning of a movement to something else. And the 20th century saw two world wars, but also efforts to build collective security and global institutions. The Charter of the UN, 1945, marked the leap forward in the world's thinking about the use of armed force. The authors, writing immediately after World War II, were no pacifists, but they were also not trigger-happy. They agreed on several prohibitions on the threat of use of force, and they accepted that the threat of use of force would be only accepted in two limited cases. The first states preserved the right to use force in self-defense, and I quote, if an armed attack occurs, unquote. This is generally interpreted also to cover situations when an attack is imminent. States do not have to wait for the bombs to fall, but they can meet the attackers even outside their territory. So, when an armed attack occurs, or when it's imminent, then the right to self-defense exists. The other is a broader exception, but that is one given to the Security Council. The Council, that is asked to uphold collective security, was endowed with the right to authorize the use of force in the broader category of cases, namely where there is a threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression. But evidently, deciding on the use of force against the threat of peace is much broader than having a right individually to go against use of armed aggression, which is taking place. As we know, during the Cold War, this collective security system of the UN was mostly paralyzed because of the veto. security during the collective, during the second, during the Cold War was more built upon collective self-defense, membership of alliances, or non-alliance, in particular alliances. However, the situation changed drastically with the end of the Cold War, when consensus decisions were reached in large numbers of peacekeeping operations in the Security Council. Today we have about 100,000 people under UN banner working in a large number of peacekeeping operations, above all in Africa. But most importantly, a result of the end of the Cold War and the possibility to reach agreement was in 1991, when the Council authorized the broad alliance that was created by President George H. Bush to use force to stop Iraq's naked aggression against an occupation of Kuwait. President Bush spoke, their father, spoke about a new world order, new international order. Now, regrettably, this new world order has not lasted. In March 2003, an alliance of willing states invaded Iraq without there being any armed attack by Iraq or any one of them, and no imminence of an armed attack either, and without the Security Council authorization. The problem with all such so-called preventive military actions is that they must rely on intelligence. When an attack occurs, you see it, it's clear. But you say that, yeah, it's imminent, we will have to do it, we have to base it upon intelligence. That's what you base the action upon. And in this case, as we know, the evidence was, as sometimes say, faith-based. Might even go further and say it was fake-based and misleading. The weapons of mass destruction, which were to be eliminated, did not exist. The negative results of some 700 inspections and at some 500 sites that we pursued through the Numeric were ignored. Sometimes I'm asked how I reacted against the fact that the likelihood that I was bugged during that period. And I said, well, I wish to heaven at least they listened to what I had to say. In my view, which is shared by many, this policy of preventive or preemptive war has seriously damaged the confidence in collective security that we have. But it's also sometimes said that it undermined the authority of the Security Council. The Council would not authorize the use of force, and it was said by some in the US that if it doesn't authorize this, then it is irrelevant. Well, it was treated as irrelevant, but I sometimes wonder what would we have thought of the Security Council today if the Council had authorized the Iraq War. What confidence and faith would we have in the Council? I think they did right. They refused to give an authorization to a war that should not have been authorized. Well, despite the flaws in the present UN system, for instance, the composition of the Security Council, and the inability to agree on concrete actions to curb atrocities, such as ongoing killings of civilians in Darfur and elsewhere, we have come a long way in the last 60 years. The European Union, conceived after World War II as a peace project between states and peoples that have fought each other for millennia, has effectively made war and armed conflict between European states unthinkable. And in Latin America, interstate conflicts used to occur with some frequency in the past. The Chaco War, for instance, is now very improbable. You have a war between Latin American states. And even further off is renewed fighting between Mexico and the United States that used to have wars in the past. Unthinkable today. So that's true that in the last 50 years there were many wars of independence. That is true. But we do hardly expect many more such wars. Areas of peace thus are expanding in the world, but we do see civil wars from various places. And we also see some flashpoints, regions, not sources for world wars, but regions like the Middle East and Africa, and flashpoints like Taiwan. The major transformation of the international scene during the last decades, not least the development towards increasing global interdependence and the revolutionary technological progress in the fields of information and transportation, has fundamentally changed the threats to our society and the means for defense against these threats. What we need today are multilateral approaches and global efforts to meet the risk of climate change and multilateral efforts to curb transnational organized crime and terrorism, and to pursue economic cooperation for security, and also a renewed consensus to eliminate the weapons of mass destruction and revive the promise of a post-war collective security system. We agree that there is a need, we all need to, that we need to cooperate to stop viruses, to stop organized crime, and stop trafficking in humans and drugs. And if we can agree that we have to cooperate in all these things, should we not also be able to agree that we must stop shooting at each other? Thank you.